So far, so far to go. Hi, Blake Strode.
Hi, Kayla Reed.
We are back again for another episode of Under the Arch. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling good because we're doing this on a Friday again, which means the weekend's almost here. And
this weekend is the Mother's Day weekend.
Yes.
Shout out to all the mothers out here who listen to our podcast. Yes. Keep the world on its axis. We appreciate you. I am Kayla Reed, Executive Director of Action St. Louis and co-host of Under the Arch.
Yes, and I am the other co-host of this beautiful podcast and Executive Director of Arch City Defenders. My name is Blake Strode.
I'm Blake Strode. And Under the Arch is still a podcast where we explore the issues facing our communities and the people fighting to transform them. And today, we're going to talk to people fighting to transform them.
Yes, fighting to transform us and communities.
They have spent hours trying to transform me. That's right. Be a better leader.
Yes, yes. We've done a lot of issue-based episodes on this podcast. This one's going to be a little bit different because, you know, doing the work of any sort is hard. And part of what makes it hard is just being a human, working with other humans, and you know, the more humans you add, the exponential increase comes with each new addition in the level of difficulty.
Yes. I often think about, I'm currently watching Queen Charlotte.
Oh, I need to start that.
It's really good.
Okay.
Shonda does it again. She does it again. And there's a character who is always like five paces behind the queen, making sure everything sort of like works in tandem, always there to support, doesn't need to be visible. But really, when you come into the castle, that's who's making it all happen. That's who's coordinating. That's who's in the war rooms. That's who's negotiating. That's who's thinking five steps ahead, even though they're five paces behind. And those are two of the folks we're about to talk to today who are just in stone. You see that? You see how I landed
making
that?
Making it all good. Happen. Making
yeah, they're just it making happen. It happen. Five paces behind leaders in this region, making sure we are headed in the right direction because they are five paces ahead on the emerging strategies that we need to have to develop and work with, to work with leaders like us. And so our guests today are Whitney Benz and Sam Strauss. And I often, Whitney's name is a verb in Action St. Louis's office. You get Whitney because it changes your perspective.
Changes everything.
Once you've been Whitney, you know, it's there's Whitney Houston and there's Whitney Benz. That's how significant it is.
And we're going to read their formal bios, but as you can already hear, we love these two so much. Full disclosure, these are two of my absolute favorite humans on the planet, and they are brilliant, as you will hear. I've learned so much from both of them, and our organizations both work with Whitney in a consulting capacity. And so we know these two very well, as you will hear over the course of this conversation. But they're also just genuine badasses in their own right. So let's give you their professional bios.
Whitney Benz is a facilitator, educator, and emotional labor organizer who works with social justice organizations and collectives to strengthen relationship and negotiation capacity. She is committed to bringing the potential of generative conflict, honest communication, and fugitive negotiation strategy to the difficult work of being with other humans in movement. Whitney also researches and teaches fugitive negotiation at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and Harvard Law School.
Welcome, Whitney.
Welcome.
And Sam Strauss is an educator, facilitator, and coach who brings creative, relational, and spatial orientations to conflict work. Spatial orientations. He researches and teaches fugitive negotiation at Harvard Law School and the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Sam also supports teams within organizations seeking to distribute power differently and build more connected and accountable relationships. He works most closely with people navigating and negotiating conflict within educational and philanthropic fields. Welcome, Sam. And thank you all so much for joining Under the Arch.
We're so excited to be here with y'all. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, yes. We're very excited. I will also add that Sam and I are avid Golden State Warriors fans. And
that's right.
They had a
comeback moment, and we're waiting. We're in game six now. Mm-hmm. And if you're a Lakers fan, you should keep listening, but just know.
I'm with you. I always pull for LeBron. It's fine.
I'm with you.
Wow, the conflict came up quick.
That's right.
We're doing it every time.
I expected, but we can go there. We can start there.
Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, while we're talking about our journeys into fandom, we do just want to know more about both of your backgrounds and how you got into this work. Whitney, let's start with you. Tell us how you got into this work.
I'm the oldest daughter of many siblings. And I think that is a big part of my orientation of like who I am. Like big sister is a big part of who I am. Also someone who as a young person was always sort of interested in thinking about like what feels fair, what feels right, what's in between like what is actually happening and what like could or seemingly like should be happening. And I think that those orientations and like the way that the world processed those things meant that my path took me to law school, where I thought that like that was going to be a place where I could be thinking about those questions. I was interested in thinking about the big problems, the big questions that were facing our society, and trying to do something different that meant that the inequalities that I witnessed in the lives of my own family, of communities that I cared about, I wanted to sort of like be in the room, in the conversations, and in the spaces and structures that I understood to be like where those important decisions were made. Law school taught me that the sort of lofty ideals and the narratives of like what the law is and what its purpose is really disrupted and disenchanted me around those ideas. Being in a space that started to erode my confidence and my enchantment with sort of like what institutions are. But I think helpfully also helped me start to see people. I wanted to learn more about how do people really make decisions? How do we better understand why people do what they do? How do we better understand like fundamental questions like why is it so hard for people to share? Why, even when it seems like the possibility of something that would be better for all of us or most of us, we take a left turn and choose something that's worse for most? I wanted to better understand what does it look like to be in the space of that and be a force toward nudging towards better outcomes. That brought me into an interest in negotiation as a sort of area of study that was present within the law school. The other important anchor that was like simultaneously happening in that time was as a student, and this is like also some personal history, because this is one of the ways that I got to know Blake, was being a student in sort of two spaces that were really important in teaching me a lot and starting to shift my thinking around organizing and also like negotiation within an organizing space. Blake and I were a part of a student organization called Project No One Leaves, doing work around housing and working towards tenant organizing and also homeowner organizing against and sort of in response to the devastating foreclosure crisis. And then I think the other sort of location that I want to name was being a part of student organizing in the wake of the murder of Michael Brown. Our response was to be a part of organizing on campus connected to and meaning to be in solidarity with organizing that was happening, of course, here in Missouri, in Ferguson. I got to see as a part of that both at that time as a student and then continuing to live in the area and be connected to Harvard as an institution after graduating, I got to see like what these negotiations look like over time. But also, I think really importantly, I got to see inside like our own organizing rooms and like what was falling apart. What were the conversations like? How quickly and how brittle the relationships could be in moments where it was, you know, the distance between where we were was not necessarily very far apart, but sort of like feeling the heartbreak of watching relationships that were even pre-existing to what it was that we were trying to accomplish in the moment, like simultaneously experiencing wins and also like experiencing like the deep heartbreak of how difficult it is to be in movement together. It changed the way that I thought about what I wanted to do. And I was like, I want to be in work with folks who are doing the hard work of trying to shift these big conversations that impact all of us.
I appreciate you bringing that in and talking and like grounding us in this idea of like all power is people making decisions. Mm-hmm. And then that means it's just people. Mm-hmm. And all of their histories matter in sort of what the world as we know it or a set of people making decisions.
Yeah.
Sam, give us your origin story into this work. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Happy to share some of my origins. So I think along the theme that Kayla just named and where Whitney started, a lot of this starts for me in my family. So I am the child of two lovely humans who have spent the last 40 years running an asphalt paving company together. And in my early years from the comfort of our home. And I spent a lot of time as a young person helping them navigate the complexity of their personal and work relationship. And so I think for me, knowing that people trying to work together is always bound up in relationship was very present in a particular form. And then I've spent, you know, a lifetime working my way back, I think, to trying to be helpful in similar ways. And that obviously routed through law school, which was a really formative space for me where I met two of these amazing people, Blake and Whitney, in the moment that Whitney was describing. And that moment in law school, and particularly for the first time in my life, being around folks who are organizing and really pushing an institution and a city in different ways was powerful in shaping my understanding of the world. And I think also just shifted the course of like what I wanted to do substantively with the energy that I have. And so that's taken me to some different places, including deepening outside of the law. So like Whitney, law school is also a moment of seeing not only the limitations, but the sort of designed failures and violence of legal systems and desiring, believing, hoping that there were other ways that people could engage with what's hard about being with each other that weren't violent and that held some other kind of generative potential. And so most immediately that looked like finding teaching and facilitating during law school and feeling like that was just so much more giving to me than the legal practices that I was being exposed to. And so more beyond there, but I think, yeah, really emerging out of some of those family roots and a particular moment in law school where I was wanting just different tools than the ones that I was being trained for explicitly.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, as you all can hear, it's one of the things that I think is really lovely about, I'm gonna talk about you both in the third person now. One of the things I think is really lovely about Whitney and Sam that our listeners can hear is that the work that they are doing, you all are doing, sort of transcends traditional lines in a bunch of ways. And we all met in law school, but you both had the good sense, much smarter than me, and went in a different direction out of law school. And one of the things, so we were kind of trying to think about how to structure this conversation. And I think we want to start substantively on the subject of what you teach, which is mostly negotiation. And if many of our listeners are like me, they probably have a very specific sense of what negotiation means. And I know that you think of it and teach it much more broadly than that. So maybe to take it in two parts, let's start with just the kind of like negotiation 101. If you're, and we'll do, maybe we can do this in reverse order. I'll start with Sam and go to Whitney. And for negotiation 101, if you can like break down what does that term mean? What is sort of covered in the context of teaching people about negotiation? What are the applications of it? Give us a little bit of a breakdown of that.
Yeah, so I want to maybe start by turning it back to you very quickly, Blake and Kayla, because Blake, you alluded to this. Like, what comes to mind for you?
That's a lawyer.
Negotiation.
That's a lawyer. Right?
Just like what, you know, what it, because that is it's so instructive. You know, like people come to negotiation with a lot of ideas or associations about what it is. What's there for you all?
I mean, we're negotiating a lot right now. We're negotiating ability, you know, we're negotiating all kinds of stuff. But I think about, when I think about as the non-lawyer in the room, because I want our listeners to know I'm now on all three sides, surrounded by Harvard Law graduates, which is, you know, I was like, I think as a regular like person from St. Louis, I know more Harvard Law graduates per capita than like anybody else. So I think about sort of this road to compromise, right? This like the end goal is something that feels relatively good and satisfactory to parties who are likely starting at a place of unalignment and what that process entails, right? Like, so I think it's the process to get to this sort of agreed upon end. And that looks different in different contexts. I think about people negotiating salary. I think about negotiating with a consultant or a firm. I think about going to a market and negotiating a price for a pair of earrings, right? Like you, negotiation lives. I think about negotiating with my puppy, right? Like please. Don't like what are we going to do today? What choices are we going to make? And I think it's less, I think, you know, maybe in my own development, it is something that is taught to be very formal and structured, but it actually sort of exists in the day-to-day life of people who are trying to interact with each other. You negotiate what you go eat for dinner, right? Mm-hmm. Blake might want Corner 17 and I might want Amigo Joe's. Where are we going to land? I don't know. So that's what I would say. That is a product of being Whitney and Sam.
Yeah.
So,
you know. Yeah, that's exactly right. Because I mean, before you all, like, I really did think of it as a very formal process. I was like, oh yeah, you negotiate contracts, you know, you negotiate, like you said, in a market, you might haggle. Yeah, exactly. Like formal deals is how I thought about negotiation. Yeah.
Love this. So thank you both. Know that you might not be a representative sample having got to chat with us before. And yeah, I think that that's where a lot of people start, right? Like thinking about negotiation and something transactional. And then as soon as they start to think about it, thinking about all of the other relationships in their lives where there's conflict of some sort. I think Kayla, you set that up, right? Like there's something that is not in alignment that we're trying to navigate towards. And so I think for us, negotiation is all of those situations where we're negotiating with other people or not with other people, with your dog, sure, but like just navigating difficulty, right? We can also think about that as like, I'm needing to negotiate the situation. So some situation where there's tension, where there's conflict, where we're trying to make our way through. Another thing that I'd offer is, I think one of your associations with negotiation was like, some process towards agreement, right? We're trying to get to agreement. And I think the other way that Whitney and I think about this is maybe, you know, if there's a good yes here, that's what negotiation is about. We also might be trying to find our way to a good no or refusal of the terms that are put before us. And particularly as we start thinking about power and institutions, that becomes a bigger part of our analysis is how we get to know, and particularly how we get to know with each other, with other people. And so that's some of where I might start. Whitney, what would you add to all of that?
Well, let me first just say, this gets me so, I love hearing my friends talk about negotiation. Like this gets me excited. I think another concept that we're sort of referring to, but I want to just name as we're thinking about like, what are some of the 101 concepts that are really important that I want to put on the table are, you know, we negotiate to try to get our interests met. So this concept of interests, which are our needs, concerns, desires, and fears, they are what motivate us to negotiate. They are what are bringing us to the table to, you have interests that are underneath why you are negotiating with this potential employer, and that you have interests that are why you want a higher salary. Salary, like, I mean, I think people can say like, yeah, want, you know, more salary is better than less salary, but salary isn't actually the interest. The interests are, what are you going to do with that salary? What is it that you are thinking about needing money for? What are, again, the concerns that you have? What are the things that you desire, that you want? What are the things that you fear that you are working to meet through this negotiation? And that interests are what are shaping the conversation and hopefully the discussion as you're thinking about, okay, well, these are the interests of the different parties, of me, of the other party at the table, also potentially for like third parties who care about this negotiation, but maybe aren't at the table, but if their interests aren't considered, might disrupt our ability to come to an agreement. Those are sort of what are powering, as Sam was putting it, whether or not there is a good yes here or not. Or whether we should be, and I'll go ahead and put on another negotiation word onto the table, thinking about our alternatives, which are the things that we would walk away to. If we cannot come to an agreement, or if there is not enough overlap in what it is that we care about, or going back to Kayla's word around process, if through the process, our ability or the relationship between us is so degraded that it is no longer in my interest to come to an agreement with you, also wanting to be think about like, well, what are the things that we are going to do if we cannot come to an agreement? And that shaping the way that we start to think about strategy in a negotiation, which I think, you know, again, as far as early proving grounds of starting to think about like, why is this so important? Thinking about being in rooms as, you know, students organizing and people taking very different perspectives on like, who should you negotiate with? Should you ever negotiate with administrators? Under what circumstances should you, you know, what are you giving up to be in the conversation? What is yesable? What are, right? We're having those conversations. They're not necessarily being cast in terms of like, hey, this is a negotiation here. There are interests that we also have of how we want to be seen, about what it means or how, you know, what it doesn't mean about us, depending on how it is that we're showing up in this conversation. So wanna lay that concept on the table as well, the interests and alternatives.
I think that's really important, because I think about that when you say that, when you say like not getting to a yes, I think one of the most clear examples of this is like divorce, right? This idea that's like, actually, we are decidedly unaligned, but we still have to go through the negotiation, a whole lot of things. And I, you know, if you're a non-lawyer listening, you are thinking about every legal show you watch, from like Suits, right? Like, I used to love Suits as a show. I don't know if that's what actual lawyers up there do, but it was a great show. I think Harvey is one of the best characters ever written. And what they are doing most of the time is they're never present in a courtroom. They're always just in a boardroom negotiating. But what I was going to connect to around my personal sort of work is organizing is a lot of negotiating. You start with the negotiation of sort of like your issue cut, your frame, your goals, your demands. And you know, sometimes you have really big demands of the world, right? We're abolitionists, we are feminists, we have really big demands of the world. And every time we are stepping into the realm of policy, you instantly are in negotiation, right? The state legislature is wrapping up, thank all the gods, this week, that they are ending session this week, today. And all of that is negotiation. You're negotiating who's going to do a filibuster, you're negotiating what's going to be in the policy. And so it is, so it's very present in our day-to-day work as non, if you're not a lawyer and you're like, oh, I didn't think about this, right? I sort of think negotiation is reserved for like lawyers and legal folks. And it's actually sort of, it is the negotiation of policy, of resources, of decisions. We do this every year in our budget cycle in St. Louis. It's nothing but negotiation. We do it inside of our organizations and the work that we're going to do. It's all negotiation. So I just appreciate the sort of expansive way that you all define that, yeah, and how often, how often we negotiate.
Can I just say quickly, it reminds me of, I may have told you all this before, but I studied economics in undergrad, and there was this, which I think is another term that people hear, like economics, and they're like, oh, this is a very technical thing. It only applies in certain circumstances. And then I took this class called The Economics of Life, which was all about how like economics concepts shows up again in everyday activities and every choice you make and every alternative that you pass by and how you're thinking about opportunity costs. And when, you know, in my learning from you all about negotiation more than once, I've been like, oh yeah, that's kind of like negotiation of life. It appears everywhere. And it's one of those things that once you see it, you can't unsee it. It's just showing up every moment of every day.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that you're noticing, Kayla, of like, it's almost never, like, it does happen. Well, actually, I think interestingly, you were like, it's almost never happening as you're thinking about suits. Most of the negotiations not happening in a courtroom. Like, the interesting thing is like, yeah, I mean, actually, not a lot of negotiating is necessarily happening in a courtroom. Like, there's posturing happening to influence the negotiations that are happening outside of that courtroom. And you are sort of trying to persuade, let's imagine there's a jury, right? But you're not actually negotiating so much with your adversary, right? Like, you're not going to change their minds. So you're really sort of working to shift and persuade those who are witnessing it. But I love that noticing, just to zoom even back, to say, yeah, most of us are, if we think about the law, if part of what it's supposed to be doing is helping resolve conflicts or respond to harm. But the fact is that overwhelmingly, we are not resolving conflicts in courtrooms, and we are not responding to harm through the legal system, right? And in fact, as folks know, as you all know, and as folks who would be listening to this podcast know, those systems mostly compound the harms that have happened. And so, like, thinking about, like, actually, people are mostly negotiating their interests and responding to conflict and harm in their relationships, in their own organizations, or in their family relationships. Most people are negotiating sort of outside of formalized structures. And so there's a lot more for us to be talking about outside of those formal structures and learning about what are people doing, and also what might we help resource folks to be thinking about what they might do or try. And I think our perspective is to start first by encouraging folks to see themselves first as negotiators and to notice how often they are negotiating, particularly folks who are not taught to see themselves as negotiators because of the mental models and frames of who you think of when you think of negotiators, you know, what body they are in, what complexion they have, what jobs they have, and instead start to notice that, like, we have each been negotiating since our first cry, right? Since you arrived in this world, you have been using what you have, the strategies that you learned, that you observed, to get your interests met, right? To get what you need, to negotiate for resources, for love, for attention, for opportunities. And so want to just sort of anchor on that. If you walk away from this conversation with anything, that's one thing that you want to, I would love folks to hear. Is that you are negotiating all the time. You have a whole toolkit of things that you are using all the time, knowingly or not.
That's so true. Okay, we have so many more questions, because I know if you're listening, you're like, okay, I want to know more about negotiating and what that looks like. And we're all actively thinking about all the rooms in our lives, right, that we negotiate in constantly. But you're going to have to wait, because we got to take a break. So we're going to do that, and you're going to hear our music minute. And then on the other side of that, we'll come back, and figure out how much we can unpack together for the rest of this episode. But yeah, we'll take a break. We'll talk to you soon. This is Under the Arch. Name Popeye's favorite food. Chicken. Show me chicken.
right, welcome back. Hope you enjoyed that STL Music Minute. That was a song called No Tears by Kiani Eshe, and you can find Kiani's music on all streaming platforms.
Yes, and we are back with our lovely, brilliant guest, Whitney Ben Sam Strauss, talking about negotiation and how it permeates every aspect of your life. But we also heard when we talked about, when we read your bios earlier, that you all teach a class at Harvard called Fugitive Negotiations. Whitney, what is fugitive negotiation? I hear fugitive, uh-huh, and I hear negotiation. I think of some wild scene in some show like Criminal Minds, is what I always tell y'all. I'm like, someone's inside the house, you're outside the house, you're trying to get them outside the house. They're hostages on state. Mm-hmm. That's what I am thinking. But you tell me what fugitive negotiation actually is. Yes. I'm baffled and not being a lawyer on this episode. I'm like, tell us. People,
lawyers don't know what that means. Don't think that's a lawyer thing.
Yeah, no, this is definitely not insider knowledge. Well, I guess insider insofar as, like, I don't know, we could talk about this two ways. Either Sam and I made it up is one way to describe it. Or we could, I think I actually like,
you're founders of the term.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's
right. No, I think we actually think about it as a recovering, as an uncovering, as a remembering, and as a perspective shift. So, you know, as we sort of talked about how we came into the work, and that for both of us, that the negotiation space, both the classes and then our teaching, even while we were students, and then sort of entering into the field of negotiation, was its own kind of alternative for us in this moment of disenchantment and sort of seeing a narrowing of what felt possible within legal systems. If our goal was really understanding how to help people in conflict, how to move towards more just outcomes, especially given the fact that most people are not accessing those systems to respond to harm and conflict. The negotiation space was like an alternative space where folks were talking about those questions, were sort of turning over, both trying to look and see what people do and also give some prescriptive advice about what can help. And we both learned an incredible amount. I think I feel confident in saying, and okay to speak for both of us here, and teach still to this day, teach negotiation workshops sort of in the tradition of the negotiation workshops that we learned within. And something that felt apparent as a student, and then as we moved into sort of being met a part of the field and teaching within the space that was missing, is a real reckoning and an understanding of the way in which power shapes our negotiations. And talking about that as we're training and teaching people about, you know, how can you better your outcomes, your negotiation outcomes, that there wasn't a real grappling with, well, and how is that going to be received depending on the body that you move through the world with? Like, and again, then taking that at a structural level, what do we lose if we are only sort of teaching, coaching about negotiation as an interpersonal activity, and losing a structural story about how folks are in the position to be negotiating in the ways that they're negotiating? Like, you lose if you are sort of talking, for example, to a worker about, here's how you can best negotiate with your employer for an increase of salary or terms. If we're not putting that in the context of the fact that we're in a country that has had a decades-long assault on workers' rights and on workers' abilities to organize, you're missing it. You're missing it. So I think early on, starting to just notice the ways in which that was sort of glossed over. And what that actually means is just assuming that all negotiators, without saying, but assuming that all negotiators are, you know, white men who are in a position to fairly safely negotiate directly with their counterparts. And we know that that isn't the truth. And it, again, reinforces an idea of like who really is a negotiator and who really can negotiate. And so the idea and the thinking about fugitive negotiation really came from taking on of the question, like, what would we be learning? What would be both the questions that we'd be interrogating, but also the strategies that we would be learning about and practicing if we took as our sort of epitome of a negotiator, if who we were thinking about was Harriet Tubman, what would be sort of our baseline, again, about how we think about strategy? How would we be thinking about the negotiations and the relationships within which you are negotiating? And I think that, that is a starting point, and that power and identity and relationship then becoming central to the story rather than something that is like maybe referred to if a student brings it up and sort of quickly, you know, sort of skirting that to the side, that being the real central inquiry of what we're turning over in our coursework and in our research of thinking about if we're sort of tapping into the fugitive realities of folks who are negotiating within systems that that deny their personhood, that don't want them to exist, that think of them and treat them as non-persons to be extracted from, then how do we think about, what do we notice about how those folks are negotiating and finding ways to get their interests met, to build relationships, to continue and have social life? What do we notice then? What do we learn? And how do we like be a part of that project?
That's super helpful. So while Kayla's criminal minds scenario is fascinating in its own right, the fugitive here then is much more about identity and positionality and orientation to power structures.
And I would just add, like, also in like purpose. So I think, like, also thinking about rather than accepting a false narrative of neutrality, what if we were explicitly political in our advancing of a negotiation paradigm and philosophy as being a Black radical queer feminist philosophy and practice of negotiation? Like, what would that look like? Which again, then what we're centering and what our starting questions are very different.
Yeah. And this makes me think about a study around salary negotiation based on race and gender, right? That what was often found is that Black women wouldn't even negotiate their salary, which was sort of a predicted step in the conversation to hiring. So then that fueled this pay disparity because you skip over, you are sort of avoiding a conflict that you feel disempowered to have and that you feel wouldn't even benefit you because of the way that, you know, all these sorts of structures fuel tropes of angry Black women and combativeness and who gets to be combative and when is it seen as a strength versus when is it seen as something that's a challenge to authority. Those sorts of things come into picture. Sam, let me ask you, you teach this class. What are you reading? What are you talking about? How do you spend a semester in this sort of conversation? And ultimately, what is your hope for students who emerge out of this class that they do with these learnings?
Yeah, absolutely. Those are great questions. Fun questions for Whitney and I. So, you know, this is really for us an opportunity to play around with the text and the pedagogical things that we've come up with, our toys, to help us explore these questions that we weren't encountering in formal academic study or really anywhere else. And so the kinds of things that we're reading, the through line for our course is Octavia Butler's Dawn, and a little bit into Adulthood Rights, part of the Lillisbrood trilogy. We're reading critical theory from Fred Moten and Cydia Hartman and others alongside those texts. We're tapping into public intellectual nonfiction works of Adrienne Marie Brown and Robin Wall Kimmerer and others who are thinking about the natural world, and lessons from, again, just other places, right? Other sources of wisdom that aren't the ones that are going to be given to you in a negotiation context that's mostly thinking about the boardroom or the policymaking discussion. When folks are actually negotiating, so many other places are in the way that you said it, Kayla, in so many other rooms, and needing to rely on other tools and other wisdom. And so some of how we do that in our classroom is try to bring into being conflict, the kinds of conflict that Octavia Butler is exploring in her work, which is almost always a mix of relationship and also power structure, where the conflicts that we face are not strictly interpersonal. And they're also not strictly determined by the structures around them. We are trying to get folks to think across space and time and themselves as individuals, knowing who else they are bringing into the room with them every time they are negotiating. And having that as present as any kind of framework for the tactical, the like, how do I say the right words, as they're thinking about sources and resources for that energy. And we're also hoping to invite people to think abundantly about the way they might orient to power, even when power is creating really tangible constraint. And so what I mean by that is trying to give people options for how they're relating to the structures that they face. To give a little bit of example, you know, we teach at a school of education where the background culture is one often of like, let's figure this out together. Let's try and change the policies. Let's try and be in relationship. Let's try and work within the system. We also work with folks at law schools. And mostly students who are going to be public defenders or try and enter movement lawyering of some sort, who are really thinking like, how do we operate against a system that we know is messed up, right? How do we tear this down? How do we operate against? And then I think much of the critical theory that we're reading also is trying to offer folks like a third orientation to power, to the structures of violence, which is thinking about like all of what we might accomplish in not engaging directly, not trying to change necessarily the system or not have that be our only modality of organizing and resistance. And so our students, the people that we work with, can easily feel caught, feel trapped, feel stuck when we're operating in one of these modalities and feeling the limitations of any of them. And we hope to open up some more possibilities as they grow weary of that, because that is a constant theme.
That's really beautiful. And I know we really want to get into the conflict work you all do with clients like us. But I have to ask one quick follow-up question, which is kind of a curveball, but I feel like it's okay since we're friends. And I'm posing this to you, Sam. Because, you know, Whitney was sort of explaining how you really are bringing a kind of Black feminist lens to negotiation work. This is not a visual medium, but Sam, you are a white man teaching this course. And white. Like what I can imagine some people being like, is this just for Black and brown people? And like, how does that change how someone might experience the learnings that you all are offering up?
Great question. So I'm very happy to speak into this, and Whitney, you know, add as well. So, I mean, where to begin? I think for me, two things come to mind. The things that I can speak into most directly and offer in our classroom space are thinking about like holding power. We're trying to think about power as something that is more of a web, something that we're holding in different amounts, in different ways, depending on the relationship and context that we're in. And in moving through the world as a white man, I have lots of examples to sort of draw on and thinking about the power that I hold. And also knowing that each of us is bringing a very particular individual story. I'm also bringing the stories about my own navigation through institutions as a young person, as a person coming into the working world in relation to educational and legal institutions in particular. that I hope can help inform folks tapping into their own stories, whatever they are, even as they differ from mine. And so that's some of how I think about this, which another way to answer the question of like, who is this for? I mean, Whitney, you can add, but like, I do think one of the intentions of this course, particularly for Whitney, is to offer a course thinking about negotiation for Black queer fans. And also, it's a course that everybody, anybody can find themselves in and find their relationship to being in conflict and the relationship to power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I want to actually go back to two of the inspirations for the course as we think about this question, which is a great question, which is Octavia Butler and like also thinking about Harriet Tubman. Octavia Butler, all of her protagonists are, you know, they're not always, but they are often Black women trying to figure out how to thrive and survive and lead in the context of oppressive, complex realities. And the folks that she is collaborating with, working in solidarity with, having complex, shifting relationships with, like, it is always a mix of people, right? It is an interesting who you're, I heard it put this way in an emergent strategy training that I was in a number of years ago, like thinking about who your apocalypse crew is, like who it is that you're figuring out life on the other side of apocalypse with. We don't often get to pick who those people are. In the same way that like who our family is, we didn't get to pick those people either. Now, we have concepts of chosen family, right? And it's not to say we don't get to pick any of our people.
Yeah.
Some of the people who are our people, that doesn't mean that we have exactly the same identities, that we have exactly the same philosophical perspectives. And sometimes it's also not the people who have exactly the same identities or philosophical perspectives or political perspectives who will show up for you in that hard moment or who have the thing that you need in that difficult moment. And so starting to think about like, how do we notice even across difference, like what might be possible and how do we start to train folks to see themselves as a part of a Black feminist, you know, mission, yeah, or our negotiation ethic and see that like, actually this does include you. This absolutely can include you. Mm-hmm. And also wanting to encourage like folks to start to notice that too, because there is a way in which, and I think this is a big part of what we work hard around in our classroom that also connects to our work with organizations. There's like a long history of denying power and power structures, right? And like legitimizing while simultaneously legitimizing the status quo that hurts a lot of people. But I think we can sometimes we're now in sort of an interesting moment where there's like definitely a lot of people, still those deniers. They're the ones who are out there yelling wokeism, right? Fine, we're not talking to those people. But we also have folks that who have sort of a power analysis. They're like, hey, there's power here, there's privilege here. And there's the idea that as soon as we've identified that there is a power dynamic here, that there could be a power dynamic here, that there's a difference in privilege or different sources of power, that means that's the end of the conversation. That like we can't rock with each other anymore. We can't figure out how to work with each other. Instead of that being the beginning of a conversation about like how can we be in right relationship with each other? What do we need to negotiate within this relationship such that we can move towards our shared goals and also be relearning how to be in the process of that? How can we be, you know, transformed in that work?
Yeah, what both of you have said makes me often think about, it's a truth-telling practice, right? We have to first understand what is and then acknowledge that it is true. And in Sam, as a white man, right, you can decide to acknowledge your power and like negotiate that in real space, give it away, make space for it, open it up, right? Or we can say that it doesn't exist and we're all sort of on the fair, everything's equal. This makes me want to talk about conflict inside of organizations. So I'm going to give one more pop culture reference. There's this amazing woman on TikTok. I can't think of her name right now. But she does an entire series on what it means to be a nonprofit executive director. it's amazing, right? Because every sort of need that comes in, she like reverts it back to the staff. This series of really hard, real rubs that you have inside of your organization that she sort of denies her power as executive director. And it's like, we're peers, we're friends. Everything's fine. I love you. But then hammers you down with this structure that sort of creates an imbalance in your, you trusting to like share what is going on. And we have a lot of conflict in movement spaces. And I think what people, when people hear the word conflict, right, it's scary and it's big and it's lofty and it's intimidating. So we become conflict avoidant, right? And I think we, as a person in movement inside of many organizations, on boards, as an ED myself, you sometimes avoid for your own sanity. I do. Like, sometimes you avoid for your own sanity. Sometimes you avoid to just get the job done, whatever can get done, right? Sometimes you avoid to preserve what you feel is a the interpersonal relationship, right? And sometimes you avoid because you don't know. You don't know how to navigate the actual conflict. We're going to talk about like how to address conflict, but I would love, Whitney, for you to talk about, you know, why we need to acknowledge this conflict and what is the cost of not acknowledging it?
I love that question. And I think the cost, I mean, maybe just starting with let me actually back up. I think the interesting thing about conflict, going back to an idea that we put on the table earlier around interests, I think a lot of folks think about conflict as that specific moment of like salience where things specifically start to feel bad. Like either we're in a fight, we're like directly arguing about something, or even if we haven't gotten there yet, like we're starting to feel, I'm avoiding you around the office, or the tone of emails has changed. Like that's what folks think about as conflict. But I want to offer that conflict, or like its potential, is actually always with us, because we are, while we are, you know, I like to remind myself and remind people that we are of course all connected. We are all like a human-sized cell in the humanity organism, greater organism. And we are different. That's not mostly how we experience ourselves, right? We experience ourselves as different people moving through the world. And just the fact that we are different, and that we in any given moment might want or need different things, creates the potential for that to come into conflict in any given moment. And we're like in relationship, moving through space in that reality. And so I think that is like something I want to put on the table, because it can start to make conflict already feel a little bit less scary. Like conflict is only that moment where we're yelling at each other. And I want to also name that, again, going back to associations, this is a part of why a lot of our work, maybe non-intuitively, when we're working with individuals or organizations, or when we're working with students, we actually start to help people begin to map, what are your associations? What are your experiences with conflict that come up for you in the moment of those potentials? Because we're kind of all carrying around our ghosts with us. So whether and how we decide to move, and whether we decide to, you know, as you put it, like avoid or not, is also being shaped by all these past experiences, which we're not often accounting for necessarily in the moment. Or we are, and it is a part of why we're saying, and that's why this isn't worth it. But I think that like, as a result of that, what are the costs? The costs are oftentimes, and sometimes it might be in a big dramatic moment, or it might be over the course of months or years, the slow erosion of relationship. Because I want to just bring some brain science, some brain thinking, like that your brain is all of the time, a big part of its job, especially the older parts of our brain, is to help you identify threats and then catalog them so that you can more quickly respond to that threat and rely on that fight, flight, freeze response to respond to that threat. And when we are in conflict or feeling in conflict with another person or an organization, and we feel that conflict response and don't respond to it, that reaction, that sort of pathway in your brain expands from like one strand to a highway. And then at some point, even if you wanted to, even if the interests aligned such that you could work on that conflict, it's too, like literally your hardwiring makes it too hard. And I'll say, like, sometimes in the work that we do, it's almost or already at the point, like that's the point at which people are at by the time they like reach out for help and are even considering speaking about it, talking about it. It's already at the point where there have been thousands of strands that are connecting in the brains of the people who are hoping to work through it, such that the conversation that we end up finding that we need to have is how can we break up in a less disruptive way. But I don't think that that's always what's needed or necessary, that what would serve the interests of the individuals or the organizations the most. It's just that it does require some moving through and into and exploring discomfort, which comes with the possibility of risk and putting things on the line that make that really difficult and can contribute to being conflict avoidant, which I think you're right is a big part of our sort of culture. And I want to add one other element, which is like, I think that we are both a culture that is conflict avoidant and conflict aggressive. So it's like either we're avoiding, or it blows up. And that's what people end up sort of sensing and feeling are the possibilities. And rather than starting to accept the reality that like conflict is a part and with us, even in our most beloved relationships, and how can we orient towards it differently as something that doesn't come only with risks, which it does, but it also comes with real possibilities to get more of your needs met, to learn things, to better understand each other.
Yeah, I really appreciate the point about the time horizon of conflict, because even when Kayla was giving her list of like reasons that we are conflict avoidant, I'll include myself in that. Like when I think about the times that I have been conflict avoidant, another thing I would put on that list is just that, you know, for those who are trying to be thoughtful and sensitive to other folks and know how hard it is moving through the world as a human being and all the things that are pulling on you, I think we also have a desire just not to cause someone else unpleasantness. And, you know, we anticipate the one moment of conflict, as you were talking about, is being that moment of unpleasantness. And what we sometimes don't see in that moment is that actually it's just like longer stretches of unpleasantness that are much harder to undo. And so the question I want to ask you, Sam, then it's like when you're working with folks in whatever setting in conflict, like then what are the skills that you're trying to help people build to move through these moments more effectively?
That's a great question, Blake. So I think I want to maybe put a like question mark around whether skills is the right frame. I think that's how people often think about it. Oh, I need the right conflict skills. And so let me just back up a little bit to root back to what Whitney said, which is mostly when people are in conflict and not finding ways through it just with themselves and they're bringing in support, it's because they need other relationship. They are not feeling like it is safe enough or worth it to engage with another person directly. And so the first thing that we have to offer is somebody who is there to understand what you're moving through and what you care about. And so pretty much every process that Whitney and I do with any kind of group or set of relationships that are in conflict is just like talk to everybody one-on-one and offer them somebody who is in fact listening to them, believing them, offering some care and understanding, and help them explain for themselves what this is about. And so I think the first piece of any kind of conflict work is giving folks the space, the time to connect with what's really coming up for them in this moment, what they really care about, the past experiences that are informing how they're feeling about the situation, the things that are hard or scary about either the context or just what it means to be vulnerable or transparent or asking for something or being met with a no. And so giving folks time and space to connect with what they actually want, need, and are feeling is essential if that's ever going to come out in a generative way in relationship with somebody else who, you know, has their own sets of needs and wants. And then I think as facilitators, part of what we can do is help bring that into the room where you know somebody is there and understands some of what you're moving through, some of how you think and how you feel. And when, you know, you inevitably are still in conflict with the other person, offering some noticing about where these two people or this group is getting stuck, noticing what's been said, what's sort of been assumed, different things like that. So that's just a starting point. Whitney, I'm curious what you would add.
When you think about conflict, oftentimes what leads to conflict, in addition to just that we are different people with sometimes overlapping and sometimes conflicting interests, is that usually what's leading to conflict is that there's some sort of constraint. So if you know, even if we're different, going back to Kayla thinking about that example of like going to dinner. So you want something different than from what I want, but if there's no constraint, if money isn't a constraint, if the way that the food comes to us isn't a constraint, then maybe we don't have to be in conflict about it. Great, you get food from where you want, I get food from where I want. Oftentimes conflict happens when there is some kind of constraint. Maybe the constraint is, this happens in my house, I'm like, it's wild to order from multiple places, so we need to come to an agreement. So it's a norm that is like,
that's creating me too.
Right, like no. So the norm of we have to figure out a place is creating a constraint that means that we're in conflict. Or maybe it costs more money, like to have, we're having it delivered. So then that's multiple delivery charges. And maybe we don't have the funds to stretch across to meet everybody's interests perfectly. So when we think about like what can help folks in holding conflict, we start to notice like what is creating constraint and what are ways that we can resource that constraint. So Sam discussing, you know, us coming in and starting first by listening to folks and giving them space to sort of talk about what's really coming up for them. That resource is one of the things that like oftentimes isn't present when we're in the heat of conflict. Things that we do, skills that people have when they're not in conflict, a lot of folks have heard and have tried and know how to listen to the people they live and work with. They know how to assert themselves and share what's really going on for them. It's just that those things become really hard when we're in conflict. So we come in and are a person who can listen fully to the story that you're sharing. We're gonna add that resource. We're also gonna add the resource to you of having the space to really talk it through, which already then gives you the experience of what it might feel like for you to share it. Because again, going to back to thinking about our brains, when we're in a conflict place and when we're in a triggered, feeling vulnerable, fearful place, we imagine the narratives and sort of stories that we imagine of what will happen if we say it tend to get scarier and scarier and scarier. It's like, and it can build to the place of this relationship will die, or I will feel so bad that I will die if I were to say it. And then just having a different experience, like having an experience of saying it and then actually feeling what it feels like to say it, even if it's not directly to the person, that creates a new neurosynapse in the mind. Like, oh, also maybe this could happen. Oh, yeah. Also maybe I could feel relieved. Also maybe I will say it and then I'll be like, okay, that's not the whole story. I just needed to say my bit, but I also, even as I said it, I heard that I was ignoring this other piece. Now I'm ready to hear you. So resourcing that.
I live in that world. Like every time I talk to Whitney, I'm like, well, this is probably what they think. Like, and then
yeah,
and that makes some sense to me because this, but when we talk about this sort of fugitive negotiation, I think, you know, there are lots in this moment of movement and growth over, you know, the last decade or more. There are lots of young people coming into leadership, having their own traumas, right? Like ACTION was born out of an uprising. There is fear of collapse because the work, right? And conflict can feel physical and harming. And we all we have is each other against the really big oppositional force that we are in true and deep conflict with, right? And like, what does it mean to hold those, hold all of those realities inside of our bodies on a day-to-day basis? And we negotiate with ourselves when to step into conflict and when to not step into conflict, right? When we feel ready for it, when we are ready to absorb someone else's feelings. And so we could talk about this forever, which is why we basically keep Whitney on retainer at our City to Winners. Because it is meaningful work. And I do just want to say why we have you both here that, you know, as someone who was not a believer in making space for this, I feel deeply converted. And I joke like, oh, I've been Whitney because you, those skill sets, that tool, that ability of to be reflective and knowing yourself and learning yourself and testing out these theories, it matters to the health of an organization, which matters to the health of our movement, right? And more is possible when we can navigate conflict together. More is possible when we can see ourselves through storms, because storms are inevitable, right? Mm-hmm. Those are inevitable. We can't control when they come. We can only control how we behave inside of them. And so we could talk about this forever, but we do have a time limit on this podcast. And so we have to wrap it up. But before we wrap it up, if people are like, yeah, I'm sold on the Whitney and Sam model, you know, I'm trying to get down. I'm trying to talk to y'all. Whitney and Sam, how can folks learn more about this amazing work that you're doing?
Yeah, so you can find us online in a variety of places. Reach out to us there. We are also working on bringing some of our ideas to written form. And so we're excited about and hoping to be able to share that with the world soon.
This is exciting.
I'm excited about that.
It's going to be a New York Times bestseller because, like... It's the moment.
We will do the same. When I listened back recently to a conversation we had with Walter Johnson last year, and we were like offering to be full-time promoters of his book, and that's we are already making that offer right here.
And I do believe that's seated, because there is no person who tries to come talk to us and it's like, I haven't read. I can't tell you how often people are like, I'm reading.
Broken Heart of America. There you go.
Like, I didn't write it. But thank you. Like,
I feel like I have stock in it, and I'm claiming stock already in your forthcoming project.
Royalties. Okay, what's going on? Thank you. Go ahead.
I just want to take an opportunity to just say, like, I mean, so appreciative of getting to be in conversation with y'all in this way, in this podcast, but I also just got to say, wow, like, Blake and Kayla, like, you are just two people who, when I think about like what the humans need to like move beyond these constraints that we have that lead us to sort of as a species continue to make, you know, the wrong choices when we have the right choices right in front of us. And I think that it is not, you know, the linear narrative of like what will move us forward. I don't quite believe in that. I think that there are people and there are moments that sort of like slingshot us forward. And I know that you two are people that we like, the people, yes, the people of St. Louis, but also just the people need. And it's been just deeply gratifying and humbling to get to know and get to work with you. I think people need to know like how deeply and like how heartful y'all lead your organizations and work to like continue to grow as people as you're doing that leading. And so I just got to say, it's been amazing to get to witness that. So thank you.
She really did it on our podcast.
She really did.
She ran the credits on us.
Johnny, like, to cut that out. I'm kidding. I will. Cut that out. That was amazing. Thank you.
Backspace. Why would you do that? No. We need people to think that we are villains.
You are tough and tender. I'm here.
All right, well, we're going to thank our guests, Sam, Whitney, and Sam, for joining us today and having this conversation and making accessible the reality that conflict is something we can navigate, right? Mm-hmm. It's something we can do in ways that don't leave us feeling broken, right? And actually move us toward restoration, which is what we want for our people, mm-hmm. right? And that's what liberation, we got to get good at it now so that on the other side of all of this, we are building the thing, right? We're building the thing. So thank you both for joining us. Yes. We are going to take a break. We're going to come back, leave all these feelings on this side of the podcast. And we'll close out very soon. You are listening to Under the Arch.
All right, lovely. Welcome back. Hope you all enjoyed that. I hope you learned a lot from that because they're brilliant. Just so brilliant.
So smart. And I want to say tangibly, like what they give you as tools, what you navigate on this, it's real, right? Mm-hmm. Like when you start to think about negotiation differently, you start to feel what it feels like inside of your body and register those choices. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, like as a Black woman who is catapulted, I don't know, it's like slingshot into leadership, it mm-hmm. it was something that I had to learn later because you do fight. You are fighting, right, in the world. And then you have to recognize that you have power too. And like, how do you negotiate both of those things all the time? And that leadership has a real impact on your body. And so if you're listening to that and you're like, yo, this is real. You look around, you're like, I'm negotiating everything. Yes. It is hard. It is you are, and you can do it.
So you can do it. Yeah. I've said only half jokingly many times that like they have the only real jobs. Like everything else is just working around what it means to try to work with other human beings. Yes. And like, that is real.
If you had a budget, you're like, this is negotiation. This is mm-hmm. conflict. This is mm-hmm. negotiation. It really is. It really does permeate so many relationships. And you are just, I think about how often I am making a choice on how to get to something, holidays, you know, like family functions, car drives, you know, all of these moments, there's just a potential for negotiation. And I think that the tools that they give you both in expressing it and also feeling it internally are just really tangible. And I'm glad that they are teaching that course and can't wait to like read.
Yes, I know. I've said before, I wish I could take their class. It. So I will be reading whatever it is that they
The whole org, everybody's reading it together. We're gonna do St. Louis, Whitney and Sam read along. Our whole season of Under the Arch will be dedicated to one chapter. if actually, let's tell the truth, our leaders, right, across all sectors of our society understood conflict mm-hmm. and how to negotiate differently. And how to think about people as people. So much
radically different world. It would be a radically different world. Yeah. All right. Let's run the credits, starting with some thank yous. So first we have to thank our music minute artist, Kiani Eshe, and her song was No Tears. And again, you can find Kiani's music on all streaming platforms.
Yes. And we want to thank our team that is holding it down this season of Under the Arch. If it feels more streamlined, if you're like, yo, these episodes are coming out mm-hmm. right on time and prepared mm-hmm. and everything looks great, it's the team. It's not Blake and I.
It's not us.
It's not us at all. So we want to thank Johnny, Angelo, and Zoe from Arch City in Action for just holding down this project. This is a project. Mm-hmm. Some people's jobs is just producing a podcast. Yes. Our team does this and all the other comms work that you see across our organizations, which when I last counted was like 8 different asset pay. We have so much. And, you know, this week is Friday. It's about to be Mother's Day. Shout out to all the mamas. Thankful for you. Also, thankful to the people because this week was Give STL Day.
Give STL. And you showed up and supported us. And we appreciate you. We love you. And thank you for supporting us on Give STL Day.
So thankful for all the supporters. Arch City, just amazing. And so grateful.
Action, action number one in the Black-led, Black-benefiting category.
What I realize is Give STL Day is a day of fundraising. It's also a really important day of affirmation from our community.
Yeah.
We feel really supported. Our teams feel really supported. So thank you for that support. And we just have a few things coming up. One, mm-hmm. you should follow us on all social media platforms about this podcast. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, all things under the Arch Pod. If you are an artist and you want your music on the Music Minute, or you have a subject that you want us to discuss, please email us at underthearchpod@gmail.com. And stay tuned to all the work that we have this summer. It's summertime. Mm-hmm. It's time to get outside. There are reparations events. There are Juneteenth events. There are housing events. Mm-hmm. There are abolition events.
DRT we just have events.
Plenty of work, plenty of ways to stay connected. And you can follow Action in Arch City on those same platforms and go to our websites to sign up for our newsletter just to stay in touch with the work. And the last thing I'll say is that you should save the date.
The party. We're going to party this summer.
Action knows how to organize, and we know how to party.
How to party.
So July 29th, 2023 at the Hawthorne is our Powerball, is Action's first gala. And we're very excited to have this. And so you will see on our websites ways to buy your tickets and ways to get registered. Plenty of ways to support, and we're going to have a really good time. We're going to look fly doing it, and we're going to support what I consider one of the best organizations this side of the Mississippi.
No doubt. No doubt about that.
That's the credits today.
Thank you all so much for listening. As always, we've been really enjoying this season. We will be back with you soon. We have just a few left this season, so we're excited to bring those to you.
It is May.
It is May
2023.
Yes. So we will be back with you soon. And until then, thanks so much for listening to Under the Arch. We have come so far, so far to go.